The second plenary lecture will be by Dr. Neil Riedler from Canada. That's an overview of sector management and governance in aquaculture. Professor Neil Riedler is a professor emeritus in economics at the University of New Brunswick, Canada. He has taught there for about 35 years, and he served in a number of administrative roles, including the chair of the social science discipline, a member of University of New Brunswick Senate and Board of Governors. He has published over 70 peer-reviewed articles, and he has authored more than 40 book chapters and reports. So he served in a number of missions to Africa, Asia, Europe, Latin America, and Middle East. And also, he has contributed to research in aquaculture in Canada and also internationally, and for FAO. Also, he regularly serves as a visiting scientist, and he has co-authored several reports. Professor Riedler.
Good morning. I should like to thank the organizers for the invitation to be here. My talk is going to cover sector management and governance in aquaculture. Governance is a very newish term for policies, institutions, legislation, etc., all touching upon aquaculture. It was included in the Bangkok Declaration 10 years ago. And what I intend to do today, because it's such a new discipline in a sector that's evolving very rapidly, that is so varied, is to keep my presentation short, perhaps a dozen slides, and then to welcome comments, insights from you and questions, because I think, in effect, we're sailing on uncharted waters that no jurisdiction has the answer to governance. And maybe you will have ideas about how we can handle the future challenges. So I'll have about a dozen slides, and I'll basically summarize the main concerns in the three expert panels that will occur after this plenary session. The first expert panel is talking about what is the status of aquaculture governance and who is responsible for what. In other words, the state, NGOs, producer associations, and the role that each of those can play. The second expert panel under Professor Jolly is talking about the socio-economic growth impact of aquaculture. It's a non-technical report, because a much more technical report was published last year by the FAO, but it's looking at the impacts of aquaculture, both the costs and the benefits, and looking at how institutions can improve the benefits from aquaculture. The third expert panel under Professor Tisdale is looking at we just heard about the need for new technology that requires capital and investment, how that can be generated, and how in effect risk in aquaculture can be minimized and managed. The first issue, though, is why does it matter, governance? Is it important? And the answer is it is important, it's critical. Economists for a long time have wondered about why some countries grow and why other countries don't grow. And over 200 years ago, Adam Smith suggested the answer might be government policies and the institutions within the countries. And in 1999, A series of econometric studies were published in the American Economic Review trying to estimate the impact of the factors that can contribute to economic growth of different countries. And the conclusion, almost unanimously, was that policies and institutions matter. In fact, they were the primary cause of explaining why countries grow and why others don't. Much more important than resource endowment or topography, for example. A similar study was published a couple of years ago looking at agriculture. And from an economist's point of view, agriculture and aquaculture are very similar because they have similar property rights, even though the risk of aquaculture is probably higher than in agriculture. And this study, published in 2008 in Food Policy by Lau and Liu, looked at more than 130 countries and their agricultural productivity and tried to explain why productivity is higher in some countries than in others. And among the variables they included were the six World Bank governance indicators, such as the rule of law, control of corruption, etc., etc. And their conclusion was that these governance factors mattered more in terms of explaining agricultural productivity than the number of tractors, i.e. the amount of capital, or the amount of precipitation. In 2008, the World Bank, as you know, agricultural prices were soaring in 2008, recognized that most of its reforms that it had suggested in agriculture had failed because of lack of governance. And the World Bank 2008 World Development Report focused on governance in agriculture. So the implications for aquaculture are that inputs, feed, seed, capital, etc., technology are necessary, but they're not sufficient to explain how agriculture can prosper over time. That policies, institutions, legislation, political stability matter as much as those inputs, if not more. So the first expert panel is looking at what is governance, the types of governance, the three types, ranging from hierarchical governance, which is similar to government, to participatory governance, where there's a considerable stakeholder involvement. And it includes not just the government side, but also the process by which conflicting interests are reconciled. And with a participatory governance that's increasingly the norm in aquaculture, we have communities. And that's increasingly being stressed by the World Bank in its aid policies, community empowerment, NGOs, and we've heard a lot about the role of the World Wildlife Fund, producer associations, as they're co-managed in Norway with the government, and they wish to be involved in managing the sector. In other words, they're not leaving it just to the state, but also they want to have to be an actor as well. The goal of aquaculture governance is sustainability. It may seem obvious, but that's what the purpose is, and the three or four criteria of sustainability are well known: economic viability, environmental neutrality, technical feasibility, and social license. And social license is becoming increasingly important. Last year, the FAO published a Delphi study asking experts around the world what they felt would be the critical constraints to aquaculture until 2020. And in three regions of the world, Europe, North America, and surprisingly Asia, social license or social acceptability of aquaculture was considered to be a primary constraint, was going to be a primary constraint to the development of the industry. Because social acceptability doesn't just affect the demand for the product, whether people are willing to eat farmed fish or shellfish, but also the supply. Because if there's opposition to aquaculture in terms of site selection, there won't be any fish produced, and that's been tended to be the case in the west coast of Canada. So effective governance has an enabling environment, and we talked about it yesterday, in that political stability, secure property rights, macroeconomic stability, regulations that aren't too onerous, but that can be monitored and enforced. In other words, what the World Bank calls regulatory efficiency, and it's one of its indicators of governance. So that's an part of the enabling environment for aquaculture. But there also have to be policies in place to mitigate market failures, particularly negative externalities, such as environmental destruction and damage, asymmetrical information, where one group, for example, has more information than another and therefore has, in effect, greater bargaining position. And the last expert paper talked to the example of feed, where there are problems with the labeling of feed in terms of feeding ingredients. The manufacturers of feed know what the ingredients are, but for the farmer himself, particularly a small-scale farmer, to find out whether the ingredients are correct is very costly and therefore increases the risks. And for something like Pangasius, where 70% of the variable costs are feed, you know, the feed ingredients are really the difference between profit and loss. Basic research, because of course there we had the problem of free rider problem, that typically basic research has to be done in academic institutions because no private sector company will fund basic research because the benefits then may flow to competitors. So the role of governance is to encourage aquaculture, but also to constrain it. First panel talks about how these better enabling policies have succeeded in increasing aquaculture growth, but also looks at some of the issues because either market failure policies have not been put into place or have not been enforced. There was mention previously about the danger of disease in Pangasius. We've seen it now 2 years ago with ISA in Chile with salmon. It's not just sufficient to have legislation. It's equally important to be able to monitor the regulations and to enforce the regulations. And this isn't just the environment, but also in terms of governance of labor issues, in terms of the right ILO recommendations, in terms of the guidelines, in terms of the right to assemble, the limit to child labor, etc. So the first panel that is just after this session looks at the three issues of the types of aquaculture governance and the evolving role of stakeholders. It looks at what has changed since the Bangkok Declaration. And perhaps most interesting, it looks at what are the challenges to governance in the future. Offshore aquaculture. And what will be the regulatory approach, if any, to offshore aquaculture. Certification. Certification may reduce the role of the state because where the fish is an export crop, such as we see with Pangasius, the need to meet food health and safety standards and certification, in effect leaving the exporters to meet those standards. The government state doesn't always have the capacity to regulate, so in effect it's the exporters who are going to have to regulate. And in Pangasius, that's the processors who are increasingly acquiring themselves, grow out operations, changing the value chain because it's leading to vertical integration. Climate change, another issue in terms of governance that will be discussed. Industrial concentration, probably unique to Atlantic salmon farming, where one company, and this is the second most valuable species farmed in the world, where one company farms one third of the global production. It's the largest producer in each of the four major producing countries, Norway, Chile, the UK and Canada. How will that industrial concentration affect governance? Will such bargaining power by such a powerful organization sort of ask for concessions in terms of environment or labor standards? Otherwise, it will move its production. So those are some of the issues that will be discussed in the first panel. The second panel is looking, as I said, it's not a technical report in terms of its complexity, but it's looking at the socioeconomic benefits and the costs of aquaculture. It creates jobs and income. Usually the food security is by tonnage, and it may generate foreign exchange. And often aquaculture has been promoted by governments for its contribution to foreign exchange, and one thinks of Thailand and shrimp. However, it's very hard to measure some of aquaculture's contribution. The direct impact on GDP and employment is maybe fairly evident through surveys. The indirect, the backward and forward linkages, are harder, and I know because we just did a study in Canada looking at this. We're using input-output data. And the induced, whereby the people employed in aquaculture, in direct and indirect activities, have income, and that is spent locally, producing, in effect, a local Keynesian multiplier. So some of these data are very hard to obtain. But governance is critical because of the conflicts, the costs and the benefits. The environment impact, agriculture can be positive. However, it can also be negative in terms of the release, for example, of exotic species and biodiversity damage. Economic, it can create jobs, but it can also create conflicts with other sectors, ecotourism, for example. And aquaculture may not be welcomed, such as in the 12th region of Chile, because it wants to promote ecotourism and not salmon. Jobs, in terms of social aspects, but these are very vulnerable, as we've seen with Chile, with sort of 50,000 jobs lost in the salmon industry, indirect and induced. And some have suggested much higher numbers when there was the disease in Vietnamese shrimp in Thailand in just before the beginning of the decade. So there are costs and the benefits, different impacts. It looks at pro-poor aquaculture, the problems of small-scale aquaculture and its lack of credit, expertise and economies of scale, and we've heard a lot about clusters that have been particularly successful in India. Should pro-poor policies encourage low-value or high-value species? The argument for high-value species is that while the investment costs are high, the returns usually offset those high initial costs. So the returns, for example, of grouper are high, almost as high as shrimp. This is data for Indonesia. So if the poor can be given access to credit, should they be encouraged to get high returns, or should they be left in effect to just produce low value products? And this expert panel looks at the pro-poor government policies that governments can adopt. So basically, the second panel reviews the aquaculture socio-economic impacts without putting any numbers on them. And it looks at the institutions and how they can improve these positive socio-economic and reduce the negative impacts. The third expert panel is looking at how to encourage investment in aquaculture. It notes, and we've seen the numbers in terms of tonnage, partly because the numbers are higher, so the growth rate slows down. But the growth rate in terms of output has slowed from 10% from 1990 to 2000, now to about 6% since 2000. The growing shortage of land and water, which will mean greater intensification and diversification, and therefore the need for technological advances, as we've just heard in the previous speaker, and risk management. Risk can be both the production factor in terms of inputs, outputs, and it can also be a market shock, as we know with salmon, with the glut that occurred about 10 years ago with salmon, a market glut, where there's an inelastic demand for the product, as with just done a study on Pangasius, where you have an increase in supply, and last year Vietnam increased its output of Pangasius. This is 2008, using FAO data, increased its output of Pangasius by 600,000 tons, which was the total combined output of Vietnam in aquaculture in just 8 years early in 2000. If you had that increase in output coming onto the market with an inelastic demand, the increase in output can be more than offset by the collapse in price. So there are market shocks. The risk can discourage investment to less than would be socially optimal. The third panel is going to look at how governments and farms can reduce the risk, noting that small farms, because of their lack of economies of scale, their lack of access to capital, find it harder to reduce risk than large enterprises. So the third panel will look at studies since FAO 2000, and there have been a number of studies done by the FAO on risk and insurance. Looks at recommendations for promoting investment in the Bangkok Declaration, and considers recent trends and their implications for aquaculture investment. And the final looks at obstacles to investment in aquaculture. So in conclusion, governance is important. It's critical. We just heard about business aquaculture or commercial aquaculture, basically the private sector, profit-oriented aquaculture is increasingly the driver of aquaculture growth, even in sub-Saharan Africa. And in effect has promoted a lot of the technological innovations. The importance of mitigating, the constraining entrepreneurs is obvious with the damage to mangroves from milk fish production in the Philippines, there cannot be short-term profit maximization at the expense of the environment. That requires either economic incentives or disincentives, requires regulations, and also learn from best practices. Some countries seem to have managed agriculture very successfully over the long term. And my last slide looks at some possible principles underlying agriculture governance, and I use Norway as an example because Norway has managed to increase fairly consistently the volume and the value of its agriculture product without serious environmental damage and without social conflicts, as we've seen on the west coast of Canada. And this is a combination of Asian Development Bank governance principles, and I use the Asian Development Bank because, as we've heard, Asia dominates agriculture production. It has four principles, a combination of Asian Development Bank principles and World Bank principles. The first is accountability, that decision makers have to be accountable for their decisions. It corresponds somewhat with transparency. The criteria, for example, for licenses has to be clear. There could be a timeline for decisions for licensing, as Norway has. Each stage in the process has a time limit. So we heard yesterday about Latin America, how licenses can take years to obtain, which is high opportunity cost to potential farmers. I think in Norway, and Mr. Jorgensen, if he's here, can correct me if I'm wrong, has got the time down from the application to a decision to about 6 months. Effectiveness of government is a second possible criteria. This would include such things as integration, try and encourage levels of government to cooperate. In Norway, they are legally obliged to cooperate. I'm sure it does not prevent turf wars between departments, but it probably reduces it. It could include subsidiarity, the decentralization of decisions to the lowest jurisdiction where possible, and that would be perhaps site selection, as compared with other decisions such as the introduction of exotic species, which would have repercussions for the whole nation, if not the whole region, which were left to the higher level, the state level, the federal level, in the case of Canada. It could include participation. And participation is critical when one looks at integrated coastal zone management, because one has to get the community on side for zoning if it is going to be accepted. The third is equity, and two parts to the equity. One is intergenerational equity, and this is where the environmental aspects come in, that basically we pass on to the next generation similar resources, similar biodiversity that we enjoy. Second part of equity would be intra-generational equity within the same generation. Could be we don't allow one company to dominate production, and Norway has limits to how much one company can dominate the biomass within a region or within the nation. Could include regional equity, and again, Norway has give preferential treatment to two northern counties. It could include gender equity. We're giving preferential treatment to women in terms of license applications, or at least encouraging them to apply, or encouraging banks to give access to credit to women. And the fourth is predictability, and this comes into the rule of law of the World Bank's governance, that secure property rights, the right to know that you have the proceeds from that farm, that you will not suffer arbitrary confiscation of your property, that the grounds for revoking a license, such as non-compliance with environmental or social standards, are explicit, are transparent. So I bring those up as possible principles underlying aquaculture governance, and I thank you very much. And I don't know if you have, if anybody has any questions or any comments, insights, or you're all anxious to go for your coffee. Any questions? Sure. Sorry.
I'm Sally Ananyasarang Pimon. I have a base in Bangkok as well as Vancouver, Canada, Western Canada. And so I was very interested in some of your comments with regards to Canada and the aquaculture governance, because right now there's a big discussion with regards to the net pens for salmon, Atlantic salmon, and the very elements that you have mentioned are actually being discussed. And at some point there was a panel that was formed to investigate the impact of the net pens to the wild fisheries. And that panel, when that just 2 months ago, I think, was formed, and they were very serious about asking those questions with regards to environmental damage to the fisheries, but also issues of governance. My main question has to do, actually, with what you mentioned about property rights and how did the World Bank report? I have to be honest, I haven't read the World Bank report on how exactly, or their guidelines with regards to governance of agriculture and aquaculture. But it appears to me there's a big difference, even with defining property rights. With agriculture, like the tree concessions in Canada, you'd be able to define a very specific piece of land and delineate borders. But with aquaculture, that's more difficult. Plus, the other thing with aquaculture is you're going to have to struggle with the question of more of public property, I would think, or commons, and shared resources. So I was wondering what your thoughts are with regards to governance, how that's incorporated in guidelines for proper governance of aquaculture, and also your comments on how the model you mentioned of Atlantic salmon, farmed Atlantic salmon, I would think there's it's work in progress, really. And there are so many, many questions being asked with regards to environmental impact, but also equity with as they relate to the lands of the First Nations people.
Okay, thank you. In terms of, you're quite right, there is this issue of the common property with marine waters. In effect, in Canada, there are crown leases for farms, which is really the equivalent of property rights for a certain time period. In terms of the First Nations, I've just been involved with the World Wildlife Fund dialogue on salmon. And the First Nations, many do oppose salmon farming, but there are two First Nations in BC, and it was one was mentioned on the presentation on North America, that have actually encouraged Marine Harvest, the Norwegian company, to come because of the impact of salmon aquaculture on jobs and of incomes. And this small community on the West Coast aims to have at least one person in each household employed by Marine Harvest. So it's actively encouraged sea farming. So there is, you know, an issue in British Columbia. It doesn't exist on the East Coast where I come from, because we're a poorer part of Canada and jobs for us are very important. So the jobs created by salmon farming are recognized to be critical.